Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. Boy, oh boy. We got one with some current news for a change. You may know that I do these once a week, so I record them in advance and we put them together. It takes a little bit of effort and time. We put this to bed usually like on a Friday, and stuff happens. And sometimes it's kind of important. The president's in Walter Reed, for example. And of course, everybody wishes him well, just like we wish anyone who gets this horrible virus, wish them well, and how we mourn the over 210,000 who have died. This just puts in such stark relief how pathetic the response of this president to this virus has been. He had a chance to handle this right from the beginning. We learned from Bob Woodward that the president knew about this. Back in February, he knew what it was. Then he lied about it to the American people and said it was a hoax. The contrast between his campaign and the Biden campaign could not be starker. At the debate, if you watched it, you saw the president ridicule Joe Biden for always wearing the mask. And, of course, his family was there in the front row of the debate, not wearing masks. And his wife, turns out, is positive as well. We extend our wishes and hopes for her recovery as well. But my goodness, how can any American now vote for this man? The focus now has to be on COVID. A number of my former colleagues were at the nomination ceremony at the Rose Garden for Judge Coney Barrett, not wearing masks. Or I guess Tom Tillis, I saw him with a mask, but not social distancing. And I wish them well. I texted Senator Lee. I said, I hear you tested positive. Stay away from me. It was a nice exchange. And I wish everybody health, good health. Everybody who's listening, good health. This is ridiculous. We have Norm Ornstein coming up. Norm was at the debate in Cleveland, was eyewitness to the Trump family entering with masks, taking them off, people from the Cleveland Clinic bringing the masks, and they're refusing to wear them. This is what you get when you don't really understand your job. So, all of you out there, whatever job you have, please try to understand it. All righty. We'll be right back with the rest of the Al Franken podcast. A great one, as always. Before we go to Norma, I just want to alert fans of the podcast that we have launched the Al Franken podcast online store, where you can get items such as the Al Franken mug, and my I Hate Ted Cruz pint glass, the caricature I drew of Cruz sitting directly across from him in the Judiciary Committee, and it's etched onto a fine 16-ounce glass. You'll hate it, I guarantee. Just go to alfranken.com and hit store. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts
to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
You went to the debate. You were in Cleveland.
We were in Cleveland. We drove to Cleveland to avoid taking an airplane, and we're in the audience, which was an extraordinary thing. I've been to a lot of the debates before. I've had a long relationship with the Commission on Presidential Debates. This one, of course, was run through the Cleveland Clinic. We all had to get full Monty COVID test and wait for hours self-isolating until we could get the determination that we were negative. And then it was a hall, an auditorium that was fairly big, but they basically had only 70 or so people there.
Including Ivanka and Jared, how much of the family was there? How much of his family?
Well, you know, we could see them come in, and it was Ivanka and Jared and a couple of the kids, and they had an entourage that included their usual suspects from Congress, Jim Jordan and Marsha Blackburn. What was interesting about that is they had set up all of these health protocols to protect people. So not only were we required to take the test and be negative, we had to wear wristbands to show it. They took our temperatures coming in and all over the place. And with all of that, everybody wore masks. And the family and the entourage for Trump came in, sat down in the front row, had masks on as they walked in. And as soon as they sat down, they took the masks off. And people from the Cleveland Clinic went over, handed them new masks and asked them to put on the mask because that was a requirement for everybody. And they refused. It was just another sort of affirmation of what kind of people the country's dealing with here.
Who would have thought? That's just shocking.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So everybody had sort of the same reaction to the debate. Well, not. I guess there are some people thought it was both candidates were terrible. My feeling is that one of the candidates was especially terrible, and let me tell you which one.
Yeah, I'm suspenseful. Yes, which one?
I think Trump. I think Trump was very bad.
Damn, I just happens I agree with you.
You know, I think that there are some strengths in what Biden did. I wish he had some one-liners to anticipate.
Yeah.
Because you could anticipate Trump being a jerk, didn't you think?
I think that was like 100%, yes.
So what was the feeling in the room? Was there a deflation? Everyone's in a mask, so.
Yeah, but you could feel it. It was shock, awe, and horror. You know, the way I felt, because we had to sit there and, you know, Chris Wallace started out saying, the audience is not participating in this. You applaud mm-hmm. when they come in, you applaud when they leave, and otherwise you stay silent. And everybody complied with that. But the feeling that I had through most of it, remember the scene in Kill Bill 2 where they bury Uma Thurman alive, mm-hmm. put her into this coffin and put the dirt over it, and you're like, you know, she's stuck there. It's a feeling of horror. It was like being trapped in this room where you could not move. You couldn't get up. You couldn't do more than quietly gag and try and deal with the throw up in your mouth.
Did you throw up in your mouth? Because that
just a tiny bit. But it was also, you know, because of the way the room was set up and the small audience size, we were really not very far from the participants. So we're, you know, yards away from Trump. And it was just scary as could be as he went on these rants. It was like having a monster there while you're trapped and can't move. And the feeling in the room, you know, to whatever extent you can get a vibe, really was shock. You know, everybody expected him to be his usual bombastic self. We all remember the debates from the primaries and the debates with Hillary Clinton. But doing it at this level was pretty shocking. And of course, some of the statements that he made, the one big takeaway, the Proud Boys, and then the predictable, as he's done with almost every official in his administration who's come clean about his corruption or his collusion, where he follows by saying, well, I don't really know them. You know, he did it with Manafort, who was his campaign manager. He was just a peripheral figure. I, you know, had him in the room a few times, or I don't really know who that is. Maybe I was took a picture with him, that he would then say he didn't know what the Proud Boys were. But the shock that he would not just fail to denounce white supremacists, but would get them ready to act. And I have to add, Al, that we just saw a story, I believe it was an NBC News story from Dateline, that the Department of Homeland Security sent instructions around within the department for people to say positive things about Kyle Rittenhouse, the murderer from Kenosha, who went out, of course, with his assault rifle and killed two people, which, you know, basically is just a reinforcement that this was not just a mistake or a misstatement on his part. This is a government-wide policy, an executive branch-wide policy of support for white supremacists, terrorists, and murderers that just is beyond the pale.
So what inferences can we draw from this in terms of Trump's approach to this election? I mean, that's sort of the $64,000 question. Is he anticipating losing the vote, but winning in the courts, or winning by intimidation, or is it like a plan that he had, or is he just desperate and out of control? Is he so angry and so desperate that he's out of control? And what was going on there?
I believe he is angry and desperate, and that he does have a plan. And the plan, which was not just in the statement about the Proud Boys, and when it's stand by, they knew exactly what he meant, and he can denounce them now, which he won't do, say he doesn't know who they are, get his minions to backpedal, but they know exactly what he meant. And remember, he also talked about how his loyal followers, just trying to make sure the election is safe, were kept out of the polling places in Philadelphia, which was basically a lie.
Well, no, they were kept out, but they aren't allowed in.
They're not allowed in.
Poll watchers have to be identified ahead of time, approved to be poll watchers.
And they have to be at an official site, and this was not an election site. So he misstated that. He, of course, lied about these ballots. There isn't a day that goes by when I don't think of the Mary McCarthy comment that every word, including a and the, is a lie. But all of it designed to discredit the election and basically to send people out into the streets. A whole lot of them are going to be armed to try to intimidate voters and to discredit the ballots sent in by mail, because they will not be ones where they can intimidate them in advance. We know now that William DeJoy, his hand-picked postmaster general, defied a court order on slowing down the mails and ordered him to put back in the mail sorting machines that he had taken out And DeJoy said, we've dismantled and basically destroyed them, which means he's destroyed government property to keep the mails from going out. They refused or failed to send out almost 2 million change of address forms around the country, which means that people will not get in the mail the absentee ballot forms that would otherwise go out to them. The systematic attempt to disrupt the vote, to suppress the vote, and then very possibly to use violence during the early election days and the election day itself, and to very probably try to find a way to declare victory on election eve and figure out ways to stop the vote. These are not just things that we exaggerate or that are made up out of whole cloth, because he's talking about them openly. This is just like Russia, if you're listening, find the 30,000 emails.
That was a joke.
Openly colluding. Yeah, right.
Just like injecting the disinfectant. That came up in the debate.
And by the way, maybe you could inject some bleach in your arm, and that would take care of it. This is the
that
same man.
That was said sarcastically, that was you seemed, know that. That was said sarcastically.
And so here's the deal.
Yeah, it was sarcastic. Just listen.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
He's sarcastic in a very different way than most people. That was sarcastic just now. But here's the thing about stealing the election. Biden was very, very explicit about saying, nope, we're going to have an election. Whoever wins, wins. Biden, I think, was telling Americans, vote. Go ahead, just vote. And I do believe that if we scare people to thinking your vote isn't going to count, your mail-in vote isn't going to count, that fewer people will vote. So I'm just telling all my listeners that because of this, even more so, the importance that you vote and that your friends vote and everyone you know votes, that's the way we beat him. Because I think the only way he doesn't steal this election is if he can't.
I think you're spot on there. And I'm actually more hopeful now. You know, people have been criticizing the debates and saying, what do we need these for anymore? And, you know, this was just a horrible experience. The word shit show was used by almost everybody.
Dana Bash on CNN immediately said shit show.
Yeah.
it was just great to see.
Yes. But, you know, for all of that, I actually, after the nightmare of sitting through that yards from Trump, I reflected on it a little bit and I thought, you know, this actually was extremely valuable in one particular way. For an awful lot of voters out there who don't follow this stuff day to day, they've seen Trump bloviate and they've seen him lie here and there. They, you know, hear about the tweets or they read the tweets. They see some of the comments he's made in press conferences. But you had people watching him in a sustained way for 90 minutes and seeing the sociopath turn into psychopath, the overt white supremacy. And anti-Semitism, by the way, the Proud Boys are deeply, deeply anti-Semitic.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just thought they were just racist. Oh, well, that's nice to know.
Yeah, occasionally they go together. I don't know why.
Yeah, but I'll stay away from, if I see a Proud Boy, I'll just say, oh boy, I'm from Minnesota, I'm Lutheran. Something like that.
And I'm white. I'm a white Lutheran.
I'm a white Lutheran. Well, you could see I'm white.
Yeah.
But you might think I'm Jewish, but boy, am I not.
Yeah.
Tell you that, the Proud Boy.
Learn how to pronounce the word Aryan. They saw what a monster he is, and in a sustained way. And I think that's going to actually help when people vote. I think it's going to make some difference at the margins. And what I'm hopeful for is that in a state like Florida, they've already started to process the votes by mail coming in. They've had votes by mail coming in for a little while. if that means we could well, if this is not close, get a result from Florida relatively early on the evening of November 3rd. And if he loses Florida, he has no claim whatsoever to declare victory.
That's a big if. Florida has...
It's a big if. But, you know, there are other states that will follow along the way. What I'm most worried about on election day itself, and we've seen this in a couple of instances, it's almost like they're doing beta tests, is that we're going to get these armed thugs out there basically blocking the entrance to polling places. Now, that's illegal, but I don't know in some places whether the police will actually step in and make them move away. And one of the things that's been little noticed here, one of the most pivotal court decisions that we've had involving elections, and by the way, we've had many instances, the lawyer who you know well, Mark Elias, has been extraordinarily active in 35 states and has gotten many courts to overturn some of these rulings that have made it more difficult for people to vote. We've actually had some pretty good decisions out there in a number of states, including ones like Montana just the other day. We had a court decision in New Jersey. A couple of decades ago, the Republican Party was suppressing votes by putting out off-duty cops in uniform with their weapons, basically trying to scare off and intimidate voters. And it was blatant enough that they got sued, and a judge worked out a consent decree where nationwide they agreed they wouldn't do this anymore. And just this year, a judge lifted that consent decree. It expired. It was not reinstated. It was the same reasoning as John Roberts used in the Shelby County decision eviscerating the Voting Rights Act. That, well, we're not seeing racism anymore, he said. Why? Because you had a Voting Rights Act. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, that's like saying in a torrential rainstorm that you don't need your umbrella anymore because you're not getting wet. And in the same way, we hadn't seen this kind of voter intimidation because they'd been blocked legally from doing it, and now they're not blocked. And you can imagine police and off-duty police standing by while they keep people from voting. And if those kinds of things happen, and then people try to work their way through to get to the polling place, they might be roughed up. We might see violence. And then you worry about Trump stepping in, knowing he's going to lose, and taking it to the next level of autocracy, which is saying this is out of control and I'm stopping the election, which he cannot do legally, but doing things legally has never stopped him before.
So the next debate is going to be a town hall, right?
Yes.
So almost by definition, kind of, I think, it's going to be different because it's going to be, you know, at least Biden getting off his stool or whatever it is and walking up to a woman who asked about having pre-existing conditions and talking to her. And then, and I hope that they will actually be able to get into issues. I'm so frustrated about something like healthcare. We have such a case against Trump. It's so cut and dried. Basically, he wants to unravel the ACA, meaning that people will not have who have pre-existing conditions will not have protection. Also, he said during the 16 campaign that he was going to repeal and replace Obamacare and replace it with something terrific. That he, when he didn't do that, he said, "Who knew healthcare was complicated?" And the answer to that is everyone, you schmuck. Except you. The Supreme Court nomination is, the ACA is on the line there. It was impossible to actually get any kind of substantive discussion, and I hope we'll see that in the next one. Is the debate commission going to change some rules?
They are. They are going to at least have a microphone cutoff provision for the moderator. The moderator of the next debate is Steve Scully from C-SPAN, who certainly knows how to conduct a town hall under normal circumstances. As we left the debate hall in Cleveland, I bumped into Steve. His face was a little bit paler.
For those who don't watch a lot of C-SPAN, Steve, C-SPAN's very interesting because they're great about this. C-SPAN, of course, was started by the cable industry, right? cable TV to put, and it's a public affairs.
Brian Lamb,
and it's great. It's because they just have to be, they're neutral. Boy, are they neutral. And I remember going on C-SPAN when with my book, Rush Limbaugh's A Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, when I first came out, and I was doing jokes, and I was being interviewed. I can't remember who it was, but it was someone like Steve Scully, and I was doing jokes, and they can't laugh because that shows some bias.
Yeah.
And it was great because I could see them wanting to laugh but not laughing, and I really respect that.
And you tried really, really hard to get them to laugh.
Yeah, I remember, oh, God, on that thing, I just said something about mistakes I had made, and I said that I'd done a fundraiser for Pol Pot. And then I remember taking phone calls, and I got one from a right-wing woman who didn't like anything I said. But then she said, I said, is there anything I said that you liked? And she said, I like the Pol Pot joke. Anyway, so the point is that Steve Scully is the most neutral person. He just, that's what he does, but he's pretty mild-mannered.
You know, if you had Steve Scully moderating a town hall between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, you couldn't ask for anybody better to do that. Any normal candidates, this will be a challenge, but I also think there's a natural sort of break on Trump in this setting, because you're being asked questions by voters. And if you go completely off the rails the way he did here, it's going to be harder and more jarring. And you can imagine an average voter saying to him, cut that stuff out. Try and be a president. That would be more effective than what Chris Wallace tried to do.
This sort of been my point, where people say, well, we shouldn't have any more debates. That was ridiculous. This format really is the perfect response to this, because you can't do what he did when they're actual human beings, Americans, are asking questions, because the next one's going to get up and go, Mr. President, you're being ridiculous, or something to that effect, exactly what you're saying.
Before we move away from what you said about the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that I wish Joe had done, because it's so Trump, for the last 6 months in particular, every time he's been asked about the Affordable Care Act, the lawsuit that his administration ardently supports to completely eliminate it, he has said, we've got a better healthcare plan, and it'll be there in 2 weeks.
That's right.
And every week he has said it'll be there in 2 weeks. And I was sitting there, biting my tongue, wanting to shout out to Joe Biden, why don't you say, you said it would be there in 2 weeks.
He said like 7 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago, it would be there in 2 weeks. Well, of course, he's never had a plan. He doesn't know
a plan,
thing about
and there will not be a plan, and they cannot have a plan. And of course, we know, and you know, having been very much intimately involved in the drafting of the Affordable Care Act and having written one of the key provisions that saved Americans billions of dollars by requiring health insurers to put a huge share of their money directly into actually what they're supposed to be doing. Once they put the structure in place, which was essentially the same structure that Republicans had come up with in 1993 to come up with their alternative to the Clinton health care plan and that Romney used, one that was built around trying to make sure that everybody was covered with an individual mandate and that you had competition among exchanges, but with a certain set of provisions so that every plan covered people adequately, which included protections when it came to pre-existing conditions. That was the core of it. And once in the tribal life in which we live, Republicans decided that they were going to oppose it and every particular of it, they were left with nothing. They have no alternative that they can use that actually does cover pre-existing conditions. And all the talk about how they would protect it is as empty as the moral fiber of Donald J. Trump.
There was no ability to talk for
30 seconds, for 20 seconds, for 10 seconds. And to some extent, that worked to Trump's advantage, because I got the feeling at some point he might have said, oh, shoot, I could either learn something and prepare for this, but I haven't in the last 4 years. It's like going into a athletic competition and you haven't done any exercise in 4 years and then going like, well, I'm going into the ring with, Muhammad Ali. I think I better train this week. I mean, he has no ability. He doesn't know anything.
And he has no interest in knowing anything.
Exactly. So instead of that, he interrupted and yelled. And so that you couldn't talk about anything in any depth at all. And I hope that at least in this new format, they will be able to do that, because you would be able to destroy this guy if you could actually talk about healthcare, if you could actually talk about climate, if you could actually, and this guy would just go, he'd just say, no, the Obamacare's terrible. That was literally a word, something he said, right?
Yeah. It was interesting to watch when the family came in and the entourage came in, but the family especially, the Trump family, they did not look happy at the beginning of the...
Yeah, that's weird, because they're such happy people.
Well, I think there may have been a couple of reasons. One, it's entirely possible that they had cautioned him against going too far and that he had rejected it. But if I had to guess, my guess is that on the plane coming in, they had some intense discussions about Trump's taxes. Melania, who's probably signed tax returns without ever looking at them and was told that she was not allowed to look at them, now perhaps realizing that the prenup involves a set of assets that are not there, the kids understanding that the Trump enterprises, which they're involved, may not have anything left to them, and all of them realizing that they may end up in the slammer.
That would be a tense flight, wouldn't it?
Now that you're
framing it that way. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you saw, of course, the in the aftermath of the debate when it was over, and by the way, sitting there, we were a few rows behind Jill Biden, and Jill was pretty tensed up throughout the debate, as any loving spouse would be. And she went up on the stage afterward, and she and Joe had this warm, long embrace. And then Melania went up on the stage and barely touched Donald and had the usual look.
That doesn't mean anything. You know, different people have different kinds of physicality. I don't think that means a thing. I don't think that means a thing. I'm sure they're very... very, very close. Very close. what I was fascinated with on the taxes is that Chris Wallace brought up the thing, you only paid $750, and he asked him, how much did you pay? And three times he wouldn't answer it, right? And then finally he said, Mr. Brown, how much did you pay? And he goes, I paid millions. And if he
millions
paid
in federal taxes.
In federal taxes.
You know, that one, you know, the previous day when the tax returns were first out and he was asked about them, you know, first, of course, he said it was fake news. But then he basically acknowledged that he'd only paid $750 in federal taxes and said, yeah, but I paid a fortune in state taxes. And here he gets up there and, you know, doesn't answer. And then he decides, you know, if I'm going to lie about this, why should I make it a petty lie? Let me go all the way and say millions, millions I paid.
Here's the thing. He was asked three times and didn't answer. If he had paid millions of dollars in taxes, if he really had, he would have said it the first time. Oh, you know
and
what?
He would have released
it
his returns.
It is so inaccurate, the New York Times. I paid millions, and I'm going to release my taxes. And you'll see the New York Times is lying. I'm finally showing that the New York Times is fake news. And I'm going to do that by releasing my tax returns. But then he said, well, I'll release it when they're finished.
I have another suggestion for a guest for you. And that's Adam Davidson, who writes for The New Yorker. And Adam has been all over this story, sort of combed through these tax returns, because, of course, the real story is not just that he lied and manipulated to keep from paying taxes, stiffing the IRS and saying to Michael Cohen, can you believe what idiots there are, when he got a clearly undeserved $80 million, 70-some million dollar refund. The real story is the money laundering. And what Adam has pointed out is that when Trump was in this dire position, you know, facing personal bankruptcy and all of that, and then all of a sudden, in like 2011, he's got this bundle of cash and he's using it to buy golf courses, all of these investments that have been hemorrhaging losses ever since. But it's classic money laundering. And this was right around the time that the Azerbaijanis and the Russians were laundering money through to buy golf courses. So, and he was paying cash, which of course real estate people never do. They want to leverage themselves. There are like smoking guns everywhere here suggesting that this was money laundering. I did a tweet the other day that was, I think it's time for the Southern District of New York and the New York Attorney General to depose Anthony Kennedy's son. You will remember that Trump, on the floor of the House chamber when he was doing a State of the Union message, when Kennedy was still a Supreme Court justice, went up and they had a pretty warm exchange in which Trump, as they caught on the audio, was talking about how wonderful Kennedy's son was. Then we get this bizarre experience of Kennedy resigning prematurely so that his protege, Brett Kavanaugh, could get on the court. And of course, all of this, the predicate is that the son was in charge of many of the loans at Deutsche Bank, which was the only institution willing to lend money to Trump when he was completely underwater and no other bank would go anywhere near him. And we need to learn more about that because, of course, Deutsche Bank is notorious for laundering through Russian money. There are ties here that are amazing.
If we defeat this guy, I think there's going to be a lot of investigations into this, and
which is why he's so desperate to do anything he can to keep from leaving.
So, Norm, thank you.
Al, it was fun talking to you.
Always, Norm.
I hope we'll do it again soon.
Well, thanks very much to Norm Ornstein. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Franklin Foer and Natasha Bertrand.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's what happens when you give Grammarly to your entire team. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Frank Foer, staff writer for the Atlantic Monthly, and Natasha Bertrand, national security correspondent for Politico and political analyst for NBC and MSNBC, join me. Guys, let's start with John Ratcliffe. He's the director of national intelligence. Let me put it this way. If you were the president, would you want John Ratcliffe to be your national intelligence director?
Well, If I was the president and I wanted somebody slavishly devoted to my interests who would be willing to overlook facts and threats to the United States in order to protect my political future, then I'd say Ratcliffe is the guy.
Okay. How about you, Natasha?
Ratcliffe had virtually no experience in the intelligence community before he was appointed to this position, which has traditionally been held by veterans of the national security and intelligence communities. He had about a year and a half on the House Intel Committee as his kind of qualifying experience to be appointed to this role. And of course, he was a huge defender of Trump during impeachment. So I would say that if I were Trump, this is the perfect person to have in this position. If I were any other president, this is probably not the guy that you want in that role.
Okay, well, you guys are, you know, are biased because you know a lot about this. Am I correct?
In what sense?
this is your beat, and it has been your whole career, right?
Yeah. So I've been covering national security and politics since I started journalism, and this is someone who, you know, people in the intelligence community were like, well, I guess he's better than Rick Grenell, but not by much. Rick Grenell's another Trump loyalist who was the acting director of national intelligence for a few months before Ratcliffe was appointed. And neither one of them have intelligence and experience, but as the president has been trying to purge people within the intelligence and national security communities who don't agree with him, it makes logical sense that these would be the people that he selects for that very important position.
Recall, Al, that he was actually nominated, or Trump flirted with nominating him for this post many months ago, where he had even less experience on the Intelligence Committee. And most Republicans in the Senate kind of threw up their hands and said, this is even too much for us to swallow. And in the Trump era, Republicans rejecting a hack Trump appointee is a rarity. So I think that on the hack-o-meter, that was, I think, a sign that he was pretty far gone.
But he got a couple more months of seasoning.
Yeah.
So what did Ratcliffe do lately? I mean, why are we talking about him? I mean, I know the answer to this, but you guys tell me.
Well, on Saturday, he announced that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence would no longer be giving in-person briefings to Congress about election security. So they would be sending written products to the committees to read about activities related to threats to the 2020 election, but they wouldn't be sending people to have conversations with members of the House and Senate about election security concerns. So what they said was that they were really worried about leaks, and that's why they put an end to this practice of having people go down there and actually speak to the members about these threats. But it doesn't really add up, because there had been leaks for many, many months about election security issues from the Hill, which is always to be expected. And they continued to schedule these briefings. So something seems to have changed in the last week or so that made Ratcliffe feel compelled to tell members of Congress that, hey, we're not going to engage with you in person anymore. Because that kind of in-person engagement makes it so that members of Congress can actually push back and ask questions and elicit more information from the intel community than just something that they would receive on a piece of paper. And those confrontations were the things that were leaking. And ultimately, what did leak was that a top official in the government had said that Russia was again trying to help Trump win re-election. The intel community, particularly Ratcliffe, was not happy about that leak. Subsequently, it's been scrapped, the in-person briefings.
But I think we also need to stitch this incident, which could seem minor, into a broader narrative about how the Trump administration has handled questions about Russian interference. And so if we jump back to, I think it was February, the acting director of national intelligence was a guy called Joseph McGuire. And unlike Ratcliffe, he was a veteran of the intelligence services, a widely respected guy, the type of person that you would like to have in this job. And one of his deputies went to, I believe it was the House Intelligence Committee, and described the threat of foreign interference and answered questions. And a few weeks later, McGuire and his deputy were fired by Trump. And so the problem is that there is this kind of relentless pattern that kind of traces back even to the Comey firing at the very beginning of the administration, where the administration doesn't really want to talk about Russian interference. It doesn't want to answer questions about the 2016 campaign. You know, this is just a very dangerous situation, because in order for the nation to defend itself against an attack by Russia, it needs to be able to talk about the prospects that it's being attacked by Russia or China or Iran or whoever, because it's a vast distributed system. There are 8,000 jurisdictions that administer elections and are potentially vulnerable to Russian attack. And so if the people who know aren't saying that there's a threat, the people down the line aren't going to do what they need to do to respond to that threat. The Congress isn't going to pass legislation that might bolster our defenses. And because of that, we're left vulnerable.
You know, it makes you suspicious.
And it makes you suspicious.
You know, that that Russia helped him get elected in 16, and that, you know, Trump is, I don't know, compromised, which we really know that, right? I mean, there was collusion and lots of it. You guys have read the full report from the Senate Intelligence Committee, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a long one.
And how long was that thing?
966 pages.
And it was volume 5.
It was just one volume.
So that was your job, to read that thing.
Yeah.
Is there anything in those 900 plus pages that my listeners might be interested in?
There's a lot. It's more than twice the length of Mueller's final report, and it covers a much wider range of issues regarding counterintelligence threats to the country posed by Russia and by the Trump campaign's dealings with Russia in 2016, whereas Mueller's report was very limited to a narrow criminal investigation. So the Senate Intel report could actually address broader questions and be a bit more speculative about what actually happened 4 years ago. So probably one of the biggest takeaways is how far the Senate was willing to go, the bipartisan Senate report. I should add, Republican senators signed off on this, in describing Trump's campaign chairman at the time, Paul Manafort, as someone who was a very serious counterintelligence threat. And also, the person that he was in regular communication with, Konstantin Kolomnik, was a Russian intelligence officer, according to the Senate. In a way, they're saying here, just flat out, that this was collusion, right? I mean, they're not using that word, but when you're talking about the campaign chairman giving polling data to a Russian intelligence officer and communicating with him regularly about, you know, updates to the campaign and things that they're doing, it's hard to describe it in any other way. And that's what the Senate report, one of the biggest takeaways of it was, I think.
And that was internal polling data. It wasn't like the latest Gallup poll, right?
It was internal polling data, yeah.
And in the Mueller report, that was internal Trump campaign polling data on Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, right?
Yeah, and the suspicion among many people has always been that the Russians then used that information to figure out micro-targeting. So who to target for voter turnout, voter suppression efforts, and how to try to swing those states in Trump's favor. It is still unclear to what extent, if at all, the Russians use that data to inform their advertisement targeting, especially on Facebook and other social media platforms. Paul Manafort's excuse has always been that he gave the polling data over to show that he was just doing well in the campaign, that he was running a winning campaign again, and he was trying to drum up business. But it's a question that's still very much unanswered.
Yeah, it was just trying to drum up business with Russian intelligence agency by showing Russian spies how close things were in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Look, if we review what the Russians did, they were influencing the election by targeting people with Facebook ads, and not just ads, right, but just anything on Facebook. You know, and it would be nice for the Russian Internet Research Agency to know exactly who to target. Let's see. Your internal polling shows that black males in Detroit, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia are soft on Hillary. let's target the ones who have shown interest in Black Lives Matter. Huh? You know, let's target them with anti-Hillary stuff.
Yeah, Al, just to refresh everyone's memory, Constantine Kilimnik was Paul Manafort's right-hand man. That when Paul Manafort started doing work in the former Soviet Union in 2004, he didn't speak the language, any of the languages, and so he needed an interpreter. And he hired Kilimnik to be his interpreter. And Kilimnik is a diminutive little guy who comes from Russian-speaking part of Ukraine, who studied at the Russian Military Intelligence Linguistic School. He was kind of Manafort's Manafort. He would trail after him. He styled himself to be like Manafort. He dressed like him, used the same cars. He went from becoming his translator to becoming his chief deputy in Kiev and became kind of like a son to him. They would text each other about everything, about women, about clothes, about cars. And
wait a minute. Women. Paul Manafort was married.
He had a mistress in Kiev.
That is so disappointing.
Yeah, no, I know. A man of a high moral character, you don't expect something like that out of him.
You know, I wasn't counting on being disillusioned in this interview.
No. So Manafort, even as he's come back to the United States to restart his career, is talking to Kilimnik on a daily basis, and they communicate surreptitiously. And so they use encrypted communication devices where their messages automatically disappear, and they would write one another draft emails that they would never send, that they would keep in folders on an email account that they shared so they could keep perpetually erase them after having read them. And there was no record of transmission. And so there's two things I think that are significant in this report. One is that they were talking every day about confidential sorts of things. And so we don't know what he was passing on. And the report is very explicit in saying that Kilimnik didn't just study at the Russian Military Intelligence Linguistics School, but that he was an active Russian agent through the campaign. And even more significantly, it says that he was tied into the effort to disrupt and interfere with the U.S. election in the form of the hacking and leaking of email. And we don't know a lot about this because it's redacted in the report, but all of it is highly suggestive that the Manafort-Kilimnik relationship, you know, seems pretty bad when we know for a fact that he was passing along polling data, but it's probably even worse given that Kilimnik was in even deeper into the Russian operation than we'd known previously, and that their communication about campaign stuff was likely much, much, much more extensive than just kind of a one-time or two-time passing along of polling data.
So they could see that Black men in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin were soft on Hillary, and they could target them on Facebook using Facebook's algorithms, which are also very granular, and target Black men in Philadelphia and Detroit and Milwaukee who have shown interest on Facebook in Black Lives Matter, and target them with negative stuff on Hillary, like her super predator quote from like 1994. Now, is that what they could do? Is that how this was used?
I think so. And I also think it's worth noting here how unprepared the intelligence community was to deal with something like this. So in multiple accounts, people who worked for the FBI, who worked for the agency, who worked for DHS at the time, they've all said that, you know, they just had no idea how to deal with the onslaught of disinformation and basically the targeting that was done to American voters by the Russians, because they had never experienced anything like that before. They had never had to deal with social media campaigns and influence operations online to that extent. So when the Russians were maybe using this polling data, for example, to target voters in swing states and try to impact the election in that way, the Obama White House, as well as the intel community writ large, were just totally not equipped to respond to it. And of course, another matter entirely is whether they even wanted to respond to it at that point. But, you know, they just were caught totally off guard.
So what else was in the 900 pages of the report that I might want to know about if, say, I were a curious person?
Now, I think that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence reports on Russia are really the best documents that we have detailing what happened in 2016. It's a much more compelling and thorough narrative than the Mueller report. It just does a better job of telling the story. And so it looks, this volume of the Senate report looks at every single one of the allegations that Trump was colluding with the Russians. And so it begins with Manafort, and it ends by looking at the allegation that Trump was somehow compromised. And I think it's a pretty fascinating section of the report, because while it explicitly concludes that there was no evidence that the Russians blackmailed Trump, it goes on to detail Trump's visits to Moscow and his behavior on those trips to Moscow. And given that this is a sitting president of the United States, it's kind of remarkable what they air in the report. They quote people who were eyewitnesses describing a tryst that he had with the former Miss Russia. One of his Trump's good friends is quoted about going to a strip club in Moscow. There's a quote from somebody else who describes Trump showing up at a meeting in the Moscow mayor's office with two women on his arm. It essentially concludes that the Russians would absolutely be trying to collect compromising information on Trump. And it concludes that he very likely engaged in behavior that would have been compromising, the sort of stuff that would have been mana for a Russian intelligence agent to collect on a figure like Trump so that they get use it against him later. We just don't have any evidence that they did use it against him later. But it's a fairly fascinating and, in its way, damning account of Trump's previous trips to Moscow.
Let me ask you this. Do the Russians ever, follow you in any way or put microphones anywhere?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, they've been known to do that before. And in fact, in a different section in the report, there's a description of how Trump's security guy is asked whether Trump would like to have several women sent to his room, and the request is handed to him by a total stranger. That kind of reeks of a honey trap type of mission that that Russian intelligence engages in quite regularly when famous visitors come to Moscow.
And the Senate report had so much detail. I mean, they actually managed to get the receipts from Trump's room in Moscow from his visit to 2013, showing that his room had actually run up a bar tab, a hefty bar tab of like $150. And that in and of itself raised questions, because Trump doesn't drink alcohol. So who was running up that bar tab, and who was in his room, and what does this say about his comments about what he actually did in Moscow that night? And these are just, there are little details throughout the report that just reveal the immense amount of information the Senate was able to collect in the last 4 or 5 years that investigators are still flagging as potentially significant.
Well, you know, he might fancy a late night Virgin Mary or two, or a Shirley Temple. So that's not dispositive, I suppose. But whether it's women in Moscow or money to bail him out, I think it seems pretty likely that Trump has been compromised. But we know for sure that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians. And we know that explicitly from the report, and not just Manafort and Kilimnik, but also the release of the emails, if not the hacking. And there is much more in the report of a connection between Stone and Manafort and Deripaska, right?
Yeah, so the report hints that Paul Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik may have had a role in the hacking and leaking operation that the Russians carried out. And then the rest of that section is redacted. So it's really tantalizing. And they don't explain how they know publicly that Paul Manafort may have been involved in this. But what it does outline in detail is, you know, the Trump campaign's efforts to take advantage of Russia's you know, leaking operation through WikiLeaks. And it's a very extensive, detailed part of the report, all about how Roger Stone was talking to the Trump campaign almost daily about the WikiLeaks releases, how it was very clear that the Trump campaign knew, it was publicly reported at the time, that Russia was behind the WikiLeaks releases. And that on the day that John Podesta's email was leaked, Roger Stone had learned that the Access Hollywood tape was going to be put out by the Washington Post. And he scrambled to get WikiLeaks to release the Podesta emails that he had been informed about a couple days earlier. So in that sense, they really did use pretty much in real time what WikiLeaks had gotten that the Russians had stolen from the Democrats to help them politically. The timeline there is laid out, I think, in the most detail that we've seen and in the most incriminating way that we've seen, frankly.
If we just examine the few things that we've been talking about, they kind of sum to one of the biggest scandals in American political history, that you have the manager of a presidential campaign in daily contact with a Russian intelligence agent who was working to subvert the election. You have a top campaign advisor to the Trump campaign in daily communication with a cutout for the Russians who was able to release devastating information at a crucial moment in the campaign where the Trump campaign could have been destroyed by the Access Hollywood tape, but managed to use Russian WikiLeaks to redirect the conversation. So, you know, what we're talking about are really significant channels of communication and talking about collusion that actually substantively changed the trajectory of the campaign.
And let's not forget the release of the DNC emails the day before the Democratic convention in Philadelphia, okay?
Right, which made it so that Hillary would spend the rest of the campaign struggling to consolidate the Sanders vote.
And therefore not consolidating it, which led to a lot of Bernie supporters not voting or voting for Jill Stein, or I suppose some for Trump.
Just to add something quickly, it wasn't even just, you know, members of Trump's campaign that were trying to do this on their own. Trump was also obsessed with the missing emails from Clinton's server. You know, he publicly requested that Russia find
them. That was a joke. I laughed.
I mean, just because you laughed.
I remember thinking, wow, I know comedy. And that is a well-crafted joke.
But he, you know, this was something that he was overseeing, essentially. And members of his campaign were more than willing to carry it out for him. And the other issue that the Senate report brings up is that, you know, they come the closest that anyone has in saying that Trump lied under oath to Mueller when he submitted answers to written questions saying that he didn't remember his conversations or having any conversations with Stone about WikiLeaks. The Senate report said that was just highly implausible. And yeah, just raised the likelihood that Trump committed perjury in that sense.
You know, that's why they made Trump take the dementia test. Gee, how could you not remember your conversations with Stone, Mr. President, about WikiLeaks, huh? So let's take this going forward now. Maybe there's a reason, perhaps, that Ratcliffe will only submit written briefings and not allow committee members to ask questions of his people. What do we think is going to happen between now and the election in terms of what the Russians are going to be doing?
What we have is history to guide us, that Russia has interfered not just in the U.S. election in 2016, but it's interfered in basically every major European election and elections across Latin America and Africa. We know that there'll be a pretty high temptation and high know-how when it comes to messing with the election. And so there are a couple avenues that they've historically used to interfere. One is that they've collected a tremendous amount of information about the electronic systems that are the infrastructure for American voting. The American electoral system is hugely dispersed. There are more than 8,000 jurisdictions that administer elections. And Russia, in the last election, managed to probe the computer systems of all 50 states when it comes to their election infrastructure. And they managed to also infiltrate the systems used by the vendors that sell equipment to these jurisdictions. So they have this incredible topography of our the electronic infrastructure of American electioneering. And the question was, last time they collected all this information, but they decided to stop just short of actually interfering with the election. And according to a lot of people in the Intelligence Committee, what they were doing was casing the joint. They were collecting information that they could use in a future attack. And they've launched similar sorts of attacks in places like Ukraine. The other thing that they can do is that they can continue the social media campaigns that the Internet Research Agency and trolls in St. Petersburg perpetrated in the last election. That's become significantly harder because the social media companies, to their credit, have clamped down on some of this interference and there's better information sharing. And so that's possible, but a little bit harder to do. They can hack and release emails and communications belonging to people in the various campaigns. And if they did something like that, they would likely do it at the last minute when it can achieve maximum chaos. And that's been a pattern that they've established in other countries. And lastly, they can move money into American campaigns. And that's something we just pay very little attention to, even though we now have hard evidence that they successfully did that in 2016 and 2018. We have the indictments of Rudy Giuliani's co-collaborators, Parnas and Fruman. And in that indictment, it was clear that a Russian individual who was unnamed was sending hundreds of thousands of dollars into super PACs.
And that money found its way into helping Republicans.
And Trump, yeah.
There's also an operation that Russia-linked actors are carrying out right now to smear Biden that the top counter-intel official in the U.S. announced publicly a couple weeks ago, which was really remarkable that he would actually name one of these Russia-linked actors who was trying to undermine Biden in this election. But we may not get that kind of information moving forward due to the change that the Director of National Intelligence made.
Can you explain that one? What was that one and what did it reveal?
Essentially, Bill Evanina, who's the top counterintel official in the country, announced in a public statement that a guy by the name of Andriy Derkach, who's a Ukrainian lawmaker, was trying to sow disinformation about Joe Biden and his relationship with the Ukrainians prior to the election to try to smear him as corrupt and as a thief and basically spreading Russian talking points about how Joe Biden and not Trump is the corrupt one and about how Joe Biden and not Trump is the one who is practicing nepotism and all of this stuff with regard to his son, Hunter.
So that's sort of an extension of the impeachment.
Exactly. So it was the Trump defenders' argument during impeachment, counter-argument, that no, Joe Biden really does need to be investigated and Trump was right to ask the Ukrainian president to do this, now is being extended into people who, according to the U.S. intelligence community, are actually working on behalf of Russian interests to push this into the mainstream. And they're being successful in large part because of Republican members of Congress who are allowing this to be laundered into their committees. So whereas the Russians had a lot of help, frankly, from the media in 2016 in kind of getting this information into the mainstream, now it seems like they're successfully getting members of Congress to legitimize it.
Let's move on to the election that's coming and what the Russians are going to do. You know, a lot of people say, well, the Russians are going to be back, but I don't think they actually ever left. And what do we think they're going to be doing between now and November 3rd?
Well, if we knew, it would be easy to stop. And
I'm not saying it's all up to you, Frank and Tasha.
No, I think what they have is a fairly comprehensive strategy, a fairly robust set of tools that they can use to seriously disrupt the election. And if I think, to me, the scariest thing that Russia could do is amplify or provide grist for Donald Trump's charge that the election is rigged. So let's say Election Day rolls around and it's clear that he's losing in the polls. And if there's some shred of evidence that somehow the process has been tainted or not legitimate, or if Trump's predictions of, you know, his allegations of fraud have some sort of shred of basis, then he's going to try to say that the results of the election are illegitimate. And so what they could do, and what they've done in Ukraine in 2014, is they could say, hack into the Wisconsin State Board of Elections website and put up false results that showed that Trump was actually losing. And that suddenly would give every Twitter demagogue, conspiracy theorist, the president, basis for trying to discredit his loss. And I think that's really the nightmare scenario that we're facing. And it would be fairly easy for the Russians to pull something like that off. And like I said, they tried a similar sort of stunt in Ukraine in 2014 and were modestly successful with it.
I think people really should be cognizant of these possibilities, familiar with them, which will give us maybe a little bit of defense.
Yeah. And I think the scary thing too is that people in the intel community don't really seem to know what the Russians are doing either. I mean, when you speak to them, they're like, well, you know, we haven't really seen as much activity as in 2016 surrounding, you know, the scanning of voter infrastructure. And there hasn't been nearly the level of activity by the Russians specifically in trying to penetrate these systems, nor have there been as many successful attempts to do that. But what they say is like, okay, so what are they doing instead?
Look, their goal is not just to discredit the election. It's not just to help Trump. It's to discredit democracy, to discredit American institutions. And there are just so many potential targets. I've heard a lot of experts talk about their fear that media is going to be a juicy target for Russia this time. That it's not like Republicans need any further evidence to get upset at media and to believe that media is biased. But, you know, it's not inconceivable that Russia could hack the AP or the New York Times and reveal correspondence between writers and editors that somehow expose media bias in a way that kind of further ratchets up distrust of media and further cranks up the anger of Trump's base. You know, I think that the Biden campaign is probably better protected in most ways against a cyber attack, but I know for a fact that there are a lot, you know, you just see the Biden people, you email with Biden people, they're not necessarily all using.
Well, just look at John Podesta. I mean, the guy in his email. I just hope someone on the Biden campaign has explained to Biden what phishing is.
There's a lot more sophistication about how those sorts of operations work. They do something called social graphing. And so, you know, they'll follow a campaign advisor on social media and they'll know that, hey, this advisor likes bass fishing. And so they'll send them carefully crafted email about how there's a bass fishing sale at the shop, and they'll perfectly mimic it. But if you click on the link for the sale, you're suddenly giving the Russians access to your computer.
What would be funny is if how they got in actually got in was an ad for lures.
Yeah, exactly. That would be delicious.
One of the big Trump issues that he's trying to push is law and order and violence in the streets. There's a lot that the Russians could do to whip that up, right?
Yeah, we know in 2016, they were making events on Facebook pages for both sides so that both sides, protesters and counter-protesters, would show up and just square off. And it was completely manufactured. I mean, these events were started by the Russians and disseminated by the Russians, and it was just to stir chaos in the streets. So it would be we don't have evidence yet that that's what's happening here, but it would be very unsurprising if they were using the same tactic.
So this is a very fertile area for them to, you know, make hate groups show up, you know, say Portland.
Russia is not stupid. And ever since the KGB during the Cold War tried to exploit America's race problem in order to divide and destroy the country. And we provided them with a pretty juicy target. And if you go back to the Charlottesville rally, a year after Charlottesville, there was a counter rally. It was against the Unite the Right. And that rally began with people in St. Petersburg posing as Americans, sending direct messages over Facebook to various Americans, and then having extended conversations with those Americans about how to orchestrate the logistics for such a rally. And it poses a very complicated question for the social media companies, which is the Russians may have seeded the idea, but it was Americans who carried the idea forward. And at what point does it become illegitimate? But we know that they've been in touch with the far right, and they've on social media, they've tried to stoke and promote and amplify far right arguments, arguments of militias. We know that they've done the same on the left, that they were kind of fascinated with Black Lives Matter and were perpetually trying to find a way to amplify Black Lives Matter messaging, and also to insinuate themselves virtually into those networks.
So right now it is in Trump's interest to heat things up, to stoke things up himself, but he also has a partner in that.
When you look at what Russia's objectives are in American politics, you'd have to say that they're succeeding pretty wildly. Some of it is they're doing that they've been shrewd in how they've stoked hatred, but most of it is our own doing. We're pretty good at trying to destroy our own democracy and the basis for our own politics. And you know what makes this situation so perilous is that Russia doesn't need to go full tilt to try to destroy American democracy. A feather push from Russia could have devastating effect. And if they decide to just kind of gently push certain buttons or to inject certain pieces of misinformation into the system at the appropriate moment, it could just have devastating effect.
What should we be looking for the remainder of the campaign to see what might be coming from the Russians or other allies of Trump and the Trump campaign?
Probably disinformation is a big one. That's still a serious problem. As Frank said, the social media companies have done a good job, well, an okay job of clamping down on some of it, especially when it comes to foreign actors spreading disinformation. But just kind of being savvy news consumers and asking where this information is coming from and who is motivated to put it out and what is suspicious about it, I think could go a long way in identifying these efforts by foreigners to interfere. The Russians, I think, probably have changed their tactics a bit since 2016 because they know that they've been caught. Not that they probably care, but they know that everything that they were doing in 2016 is kind of out there as having been tried and true. So paying attention to things that I think the intel community is trying to put out there about the people and the individuals who are pursuing these Russian efforts is also important, because as opposed to 2016, when the intel community was extremely tight-lipped about any of this stuff because Obama didn't want to put his finger on the scale, we've actually seen a bit more transparency this time around coming from FBI, DHS, and the intel community writ large about Russia's motives and about, you know, what they're actually trying to do, which is undermine Biden. Those are pretty remarkable statements for them to be putting out. And experts say that we just really need to read between the lines on these things and recognize that this is them trying to be proactive this time around.
One of the things, Al, that makes it so hard is that a lot of what they're doing is imperceptible. To give you an example, the last time around, they created a lot of content on social media. They created memes and photos and slogans, and they were very active generators of theories and rhetoric. And this time around, in order to not get caught by the social media companies, their accounts are less active in terms of generating actual substance, and they exist in order to amplify or to kind of place their thumb on the scale of the argument. The other thing that they really want us to do is to kind of lose our sense of balance. They want us to panic about their own presence, really. They're delighted that Americans are so obsessed with Russian interference because we're inflating their significance in the world. We're making them seem like they're omnipotent actors on the global stage, and that makes them feel good. That makes Putin feel like he's he's bolstering his reputation with his own people and bolstering his global reputation as a villain.
So what you're saying is I probably shouldn't air this.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe we're just, Al Franken, handmaiden of Vladimir Putin.
Okay, guys. So don't panic, everyone.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.